Greetings and resolute deliberations, my voraciously cerebral listeners, and welcome to this January 2015 Science News Update. I'm your host for this adorably naive science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Happy New Year. I pray thee that thou's new annuum exceeds the preceding one by many a degree, or something like that. The first story of the night is especially for all of you. Including me, who have made a resolution for this year that you will exercise more and get in fantastic shape. I wish it was that easy. This story may explain why so many people abandon the gym after a couple of weeks. I've known many people in my life who love to exercise. They're highly motivated, and they go to the gym several days a week or run for miles a day. My younger sister falls into this category. She runs a couple of miles every day and has competed in many road races, including marathons. I, however, have lacked this motivation since about the time that, well, high school ended, which is many a decade ago now. It turns out that for wild mice and for some humans like my sister, going for a run can be naturally enjoyable. Now researchers seem to be, well, one step closer to figuring out why it is enjoyable for some people and not for others. Dr. Eric Turner of the Seattle Children's Research Institute's Center for Integrative Brain Research has identified a small area deep in the brain whose absence turns active mice into couch potatoes. Ah, my mouse brethren! Turner's work is described in this month's latest issue of the Journal of Neuroscience. In the new study, Turner's team created conditional knockout mice lacking the nuclear transcription factor BM3A. Now, that is a molecule that's involved in neuronal development, and it's been studied for many years. They shut it off in the dorsal media habendula. And the loss of this protein, BM3A, during neuronal development, during brain development, wiped out neurons in that particular area. So these mice were born without the dorsal media habendula. Now, originally, Turner planned to study the DMH's role in the sleep-wake rhythm. However, he says, quote, "The first thing we noticed about the mice with no DMH is that they just ran a whole lot less. We did a battery of behavioral tests and found that the animals could move and balance normally. They just didn't like to run or drink sugar water or really do much of anything," unquote. Ah, so, in short, he made couch potato mice. Turner then took new technology to create something called optogenetic mouse mutants. Now, in an optogenetic mutant, you can actually use light to turn cells in a brain area on or off, and you can then use that to confirm that a particular area is involved in a particular motivation. One set of those mice could choose to activate the dorsal media habendula by turning a small wheel with their paws, which in turn activated the light in the brain, which then activated that particular area of the brain. So, those mutant mice actually preferred the wheel that activated the dorsal media habendula over the one that didn't. So the couch potato mice found that by activating the DMH, they were rewarded, just like humans who exercise feel they're rewarded by the actual process of exercise. Ergo, the medial dorsal habendula must be involved in brain reward for exercise. Ta-da! I think that my DMH is way underdeveloped, or perhaps not there, or perhaps it just goes away as you age. I don't know. One of those things. Anyway, next story. The Kardashian Index. Seriously, you're thinking, is he really going to talk about the Kardashians? Just be patient a moment. I came across this particular research article by accident. It was in the December issue of the journal Genome Biology, and frankly, I'm not entirely sure why it was in that journal at all. I mean, at first, I thought it was some kind of a joke. Until I actually read it and realized that these people were semi-serious. The paper is by Neil Hall of the University of Liverpool and is entitled The Kardashian Index, a Measure of Discrepant Social Media Profile for Scientists. Now, if that doesn't catch your eye in a table of contents, nothing will. Essentially, Hall says that Kim Kardashian and her ilk are famous simply for being famous. They have contributed little or nothing to society, and yet their blogs and tweets are read by uncounted millions who hang on their every word. Hall says, quote, "So you could say that her celebrity buys success, which buys greater celebrity. Her fame has meant that comments by Kardashian on issues such as Syria have been widely reported in the press. Sadly, her interjection on the crisis has not yet led to a let-up in the violence," unquote. So what does this silliness have to do with science? Hall states that he is worried that there are now celebrity scientists who have done little or no real science, but have become major figures in the world of science. He states, quote, "I am concerned that phenomenon, similar to that of Kim Kardashian, may also exist in the scientific community. I think it is possible that there are individuals who are famous for being famous, or, to put it in scientific jargon, renowned for being renowned. We are all aware that certain people are seemingly invited as keynote speakers, not because of their contributions to the published literature, but because of who they are," unquote. Let's assume he is not talking about me. I think I can prove my bona fides, if needed, okay? So what did Turner do to examine if his hypothesis can be supported? He selected research scientists and recorded their number of Twitter followers. He picked 40 random genomic scientists and obtained their citation metrics. In other words, how often they were cited, their papers were cited. He picked only individuals who have been on Twitter for some time, and he deliberately overlooked people who were on major genomic papers, like the first Human Genome Project, because that would overinflate the citation scores. He also captured whether the scientists were men or women. He then plotted the number of citations against the number of Twitter followers of each of these scientists. And his results found that there is a positive trend in scientific value when compared with that of celebrity. In other words, usually those scientists who are valued for being scientists were also valued for their Twitter feeds. Additionally, Turner calculated what he called the Kardashian Index, or the K Index. A high K index is a warning to the community that researcher X may have built their public profile on shaky foundations, while a very low K index suggests that a scientist is being undervalued. Turner proposes, quote, that those people whose K index is greater than 5 can be considered scientific Kardashians, unquote. And he suggests that he has found a number of them in his study, although he does not name names. He finishes with this, quote, "I propose that all scientists calculate their own K index on an annual basis and include it in their Twitter profile. Not only does this help others decide how much weight they should give to somebody's 140-character wisdom, it can also be an incentive. If your K index gets above 5, then it's time to get off Twitter and write those scientific papers." Unquote. Out of curiosity, I did calculate my own K-index using my Facebook follower number. I don't tweet. I came up with a number way below 5, close to Turner's, which is about 1. So I'm feeling a bit undervalued today. What can I say? Next story. Do you like to play poker? Now, I've played, but I've never gotten very serious because I'm extraordinarily risk-averse when it comes to betting. I'm just not a big gambler. Now, we know that computers have been used to beat humans at games like chess, where the sheer number of calculations that the computer can do per second can overwhelm even a master class human chess player. But what about a game like poker? We're talking a very complex human game, which not only takes into account chance itself, but the very human process of bluffing and reading of other players. Is it possible for a computer to play world-class poker? Well, according to a new article in the latest issue of the journal Science this month, the answer is very much yes. Dr. Michael Bowling headed up a team of computer scientists from the University of Alberta to answer, well, that very question. Several quote-unquote perfect information games where both contestants can see everything on the board before making a decision have been solved. And those games include family favorites, checkers, chess, tic-tac-toe, even Connect Four. But to this point, imperfect information games, where the players don't have full knowledge of past events, have remained, well, elusive. Bowling says, quote, "Poker has been a challenge problem for artificial intelligence going back over 40 years, and until now, heads-up limit Texas Hold'em poker was unsolved," unquote. Now, if you look at the statistics and the variance, heads-up limit Texas Hold'em is actually the smallest variant of poker, possessing only 3 times 10 to the 17th possible states, placing it between Connect Four and checkers in complexity. But due to the imperfect nature of the game, many states cannot be distinguished by players, creating additional complexity when it comes to finding a solution. Bowling and his colleagues employed a, quote, counterfactual regret minimization algorithm, or CFR, to solve this problem. The CFR is an iterative method wherein, quote, through repeated rounds of self-play between two regret minimizing algorithms, an equilibrium can be determined for the best utility of play, unquote. If you understand exactly what that means, then more power to you. Now, I pride myself on my computer science knowledge, but that is beyond me. I guess simplified to the extreme, the CFR is a learning algorithm that the computer keeps playing until it comes up with the best algorithm to play the game. So, to arrive at the perfect poker playing solution, the researchers used 200 computational nodes, dividing the game into 110,565 subgames on 199 nodes that would feed back continuous updates to a single parental node. Bowling explains, quote, "The system was trained against itself, playing the equivalent of more than a billion hands of poker. With each hand, it improved its play, refining itself closer and closer to the perfect solution. The computer was trained for 2 months using 4,000 CPUs, each considering over 6 billion hands every second. This is more poker than has been played by the entirety of the human race, ever." Unquote. After 68 days of virtual poker, using a total of 900 core years of computation, the researchers arrived at their answer, effectively solving heads-up limit Texas Hold'em. In short, Bowling's computer can now kick anyone's butt in poker. Yippee? While this computational solution might be a welcome development for, I guess, some poker players, and probably extremely unwelcome to casinos, and I don't really feel bad for the casinos, the findings themselves actually extend beyond poker. Bowling concludes the article with this, quote, "The breakthrough behind this result is a general algorithmic advance that makes game theoretic reasoning in large-scale models of any sort much more tractable in the future," unquote. In other words, watch out. Monopoly is next. Next story. Robert Frost. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction ice is also great and would suffice. This poetic moment has been brought to you by global warming. It's just not getting better. The NOAA, National Climatic Data Center, published their State of the Climate Global Analysis for 2014, just this month. It was more than a bit depressing. For the third time this relatively new 21st century, the world has set a new record for the hottest year on the books. Last year was the warmest year since scientists started keeping records in 1880, according to the January 16th joint announcement by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and NASA. In 2014, the average global surface temperature measured 0.69 degrees Celsius above the 20th century's average temperature of 13.9 degrees Celsius. The rise makes 2014 the 38th consecutive year with above-average heat. In 2010 and 2005, which now tie for the second warmest year, average temperatures were 0.65 degrees above last century's average. Steamy seas seem to largely push 2014 into the record books. Global ocean surface temperatures were the highest ever recorded at 0.57 degrees Celsius, higher than last century's average of 16.1 degrees Celsius. Average temperatures over land ranked the fourth highest on record. Dr. Gavin Schmidt, director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York City, said in a press conference, quote, "The trends in greenhouse gases are continuing, and so we may anticipate further record highs in the years to come," unquote. Despite the worldwide warm-up, much of North America saw unusually cool conditions in 2014. Variations in the polar jet stream moved cold air southward into North America and helped cause a particularly cold beginning to the year, which I can vouch dumped feet and feet of snow here in the Northeast. But it doesn't look that good for the future, and at the moment, at least here in the Northeast again, we have no snow. Literally no snow here, at least in the New York, New Jersey area. It's really quite amazing and quite a worry for me. Well, onward and downward, I guess. When I was a kid, one of my favorite books was a story called Never Tease a Weasel by Jean Condor Soule, which was designed to teach children not to tease. As the story states, quote, "Never tease a weasel because a weasel will not like it and teasing isn't nice," unquote. What the story didn't say was that a weasel will likely bite your hand off if you annoy it. Well, you may want to not tease a house cat either. Although not as potentially biting as a weasel, a house cat's bite may be extraordinarily harmful. Dr. Brian Carlson, a hand surgeon at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and his team published their analysis of cat bite severity recently in the Journal of Hand Surgery. Dr. Carlson reviewed every cat bite to the hand that sent an individual to a Mayo Clinic doctor's office, or ER, from 2009 to 2011. Hands, you see, are the most common target of cat bites. They also have a lot of tendons and joints, which lack circulation and thus are prone to bad infections because they are largely unprotected by circulating immune cells. The study included 193 patients, most of whom were treated and released, usually getting oral antibiotics, but 57 patients needed to be hospitalized for an average of 3 days. More on that in a second. Those people received stronger antibiotics, and very often they were intravenous, and they were monitored in case their conditions worsened. And indeed, 38 patients didn't improve on drugs alone, and they actually needed surgery to remove dead tissue and clean the wound. Carlson says that, quote, Surgery might seem like an extreme response to a cat bite, but if the tissue is dead, it's never going to fight the infection. It's just going to be a culture medium for growing bacteria, unquote. The article also states that cat saliva typically contains a microbe called Pasteurella multicida, which is more virulent than staph or strep infections. It's a tough customer. It needs to be taken seriously. Pasteurella infections often require multiple antibiotic treatment, penicillin, tetracycline, or broad-spectrum antibiotics all at the same time. I was particularly taken with this story because years ago, maybe 10 years ago, at a picnic at my home, one of my graduate students was bitten on the hand by my diabetic cat, who was having a bout of low sugar. The ironic part was that my student had cat sat for my feline a number of times, but apparently that familiarity meant nothing when low sugar hits. We rushed my poor student to the hospital, and she was severely injured, and she spent several days with a swollen hand in the hospital undergoing surgery and massive doses of antibiotics. When she recovered from the main infection, she underwent weeks of physical therapy before her hand was even close to normal again. My wife and I felt so horrid about the whole thing, we paid for any hospital bills not covered by my student's insurance. In short, never underestimate a cat bite. They are much more dangerous than you think. If redness and swelling appear from a bite, seek medical attention immediately. Just because it is a small bite or does not appear to be very deep does not mean it is not very serious. Although in the case of my student, it was quite a deep bite, and in fact, my cat hung onto her hand and wouldn't let go until we pried his jaws loose. Not a good situation. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Keep your Kardashian index low. Play something besides Heads Up, Limit, Texas Hold'em. Never tease a kitty. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.